like some CDs that Steve mastered.
Sort of the history of my mastering career is
just very cool.
There.
Yeah. And a couple copies of his book, Desktop Mastering. And we've got some AES bling here. Lots of cool stuff. So if you haven't filled out a sign-up sheet, please do so.
And the books are available for sale, too.
And books are.
For the people that didn't win them.
Yes.
How much?
Well, their list price at the back says $29.99, but I believe it's $25 tax included tonight. Mm-hmm. And credit cards are available.
Tonight only.
So, are we recording, Gary? Okay,
good. What we like to do usually is go around the room and have everyone introduce themselves just briefly and say what your connection is to audio and or Steve. So if we could do that, it'd be great. Starting over here.
Doug Heyman. I play guitar mostly and dabble with some recording and go out and check lots of live music as well.
Dave Huber. Musician, author, longtime buddy of this dude.
Rich Williams. I do recording, and I also have a business called Lunchbox Audio. I have free carts for you to take if you ever need gear. I get 10% off, and they're on the table there.
Hi, I'm Christian Heilman, and I'm Mixer Guy. And I'm also Steve's producer. I produced all the music we've made under the Ars Divina banner. And I'm a live and studio audio engineer.
And all that stuff is included on the DVD-ROM.
I'm Mark Rogers. I'm a consultant in audio-video.
I'm Bob Smith. I work for Physiocontrol as an acoustic researcher during the day, and in the evenings I run SoundSmith Labs, and I'm a committee member.
I'm Steve Wilkins. I'm a liberal arts major. I'm glad you guys let me in.
I'm Bob Moses. I've known Steve for 25 years. Almost 25 years. Done a lot of product design with Steve, and then recently made a career shift and took over running AES.
And he has one of the nicest blurbs on the back of the book.
I'm Jim Allentenny. I teach audio engineering in this building.
Chris Lund, I'm a audio engineering student here at Sterling.
I'm Gary Louie, I'm the secretary of this AES section, and I work at the University of Washington School of Music as their recording guy.
I'm Ray Miller, longtime friend of Steve's. I used to design digital audio products.
For Rain Corporation. We've known each other since I was 4 years old, and he was in my first band, and anyway, that was
fun. Gary Selmes, I'm a songwriter, and Steve's mailman.
and a sometime client, which is what we'll get into later as far as how the client base exists.
My name is Jason. I'm in technology consulting with a company called Slalom Consulting, but I'm a pretty serious songwriter on the side, and working on my fifth CD and getting deeper and deeper into the details of audio, so.
My name is Nathan Hasbargen. I mostly do live sound.
John Janice, I produce the Northwest Shred Fest. It's a CD compilation every year. It comes out with local talent, guitar players. And I'm also a guitar player, shredder type.
Mark Dance, studio owner, mixing, mastering.
Ed Gruce, just finished my paralegal degree at Highland College, hoping to work in IP, also a musician and do live sound.
Cal Taylor, I teach electronics at Centralia Community College, musician, do some live sound, live recording, repair work, a little bit of everything.
Dave Campbell, I do live sound and some recording and also.
I'm Dick Franks, and this is my first meeting here. Just celebrated 40 years of doing sound. I do live sound recording, live recording, currently working for 6 bands in the area. And the mailman over there, I used to work for a mailman who now has about 30 albums out. And from Chicago, named John Prine. So yeah. I don't know if you've heard of him.
I'm from Chicago.
The singing mailman, they call him.
I am Rick Spargiassi. I've been doing mostly video engineering there at the Key Arena. Also do audio over there at Seattle Center. Occasionally we'll do sound over at the Benaroya Hall, and occasionally we'll do rigging at the Convention Center in downtown Seattle. And also run a company called Integrated Light and Sound, and we do lighting, sound, video, and rigging.
My name is Bill Levy. I have a company called Via Audio. I do location recording.
I'm Dave Ellis. I'm a student at Northwest University Creatio Audio Engineering Certificate Program.
I'm Bruce Brown. I'm owner engineer and mastering engineer at Puget Sound Studios.
I'm Scott Mearns. I work for Motorola Mobility, do some effects processing for the mobile devices, and I am a committee member.
I'm Andy Lako, and I do a little bit of recording and DJ work.
I'm Paul Schechter. I'm producing a local rock band, and I'm also their recording and mixing engineer, hoping to be their mastering engineer as well.
What's the band?
It's called Hidden History.
Jay Kenny, studio owner, Audio Logic.
I'm Renee Shrewsbury. This is my daughter Anna, and we are family.
Sister-in-law. Thanks for coming.
Joel Calder, visitor tonight, musician, recordist, friend of Steve's.
And Christian.
And Christian. Great. Welcome. Thank you all for coming. We have one point where ADS member.
Raise your hands. We'll count you. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. Okay.
All right. So I'm really excited about this topic. I asked Steve if he would give a talk on his new book, and the timing worked out just great. So this is stuff that I've always wanted to know. I'm totally amateur, but that's why I joined AES, because I wanted to learn. And this is a great guy to learn from. So, we have a message by proxy from Bill Gibson, who is the developmental editor at Hal Leonard Performing Arts Publishing Group, who published Steve's book. So I'm gonna read that to you. I'd like to express my sincere apologies for missing tonight's event. I wanted to be able to say nice stuff about Steve in person. When I got the call that one of our authors signed before I took my current position, had to back out of desktop mastering, I knew instantly who that title was designed for, our own Steve Turnage. Getting to know Steve over the past handful of years, I've been extremely impressed by the way he works and thinks and lives. The first time I sat with him in his studio, I learned a few key things about mastering that are fundamentally necessary but uncommonly known. His sheer mental horsepower, his design background and his creativity all add up to a perfect storm of intellectual dexterity. Oh my God, Steve, I think you owe me $20 for that one. Anyway, desktop mastering is an excellent resource and instantly shot up to the top of its category at Amazon.com. With everyone at Hal Leonard in agreement, we signed Steve to write Zen and the Art of Mastering. If you know Steve at all, you'll know that he and the book are meant for each other. Have a great evening. Sorry I can't be there with you. Bill Gibson, Hal Leonard Publishing. Right. And with that, give you Steve Turnage.
Hi there.
Well, thank you all for coming
out tonight. It's greatly appreciated, and the people I know and the people that I've yet to know, really good. It's my first book, and it's interesting the way it's come up because I followed my passion, essentially, to get here. And what I wanted to do as in way of introduction is actually read the original introduction that was in the book that got knocked out because it was too long and too personal. But the book was sort of about the way that I work, actually. And before that, as you can tell, I'm very well prepared. And I'm open to questions as we go along, too, whenever anything comes up. What I think I'm going to do first is read the chapter headings to give you an idea of what's in the book, and then we'll go on and see if there's any questions, and then go on and read the original introduction. So the first aspect is a conceptual overview of desktop mastering. So I have everything in the box completely, and it's a chain of plugins, and I tell what my chain is. and it's been developed since about 1997. And that'll be in the introduction there. And it seems to be working, but what I'm using is about 5 years old. You know, I'm using SoundForge 6 because it's the last stable version of it, and I use some Waves plugins from 5 years ago, so it's nicely pre-obsoleted for your enjoyment. So I didn't go out and buy the new thing, so you can tell where it's at. So it looks like a classic book already, which was nice. the sad part is it feels like it's sort of a prototype, because all these flags are places that I found little issues, but they're mostly having to do with see figure on the right when it's obviously on the left, you know, or something. So hopefully that'll be fine, and it'll turn it into a collector's item, first edition. So get yours now. So the beginning is a conceptual overview of desktop mastering, and I think I will actually read through what that is as far as what my chain functional component stages are to begin with. Welcome. Come in. Well, we're just growing. Gonna have to get more chairs pretty soon. So the functional component stages are: the first stage is low-end frequency control. Second stage is noise reduction. The third stage is stereo enhancement. The fourth optional stage, and very rare, is reverb. The fifth stage, which is more occasional, is de-essing. The sixth stage is multiband compression, expansion, and equalization, which I use a Wave C4 to implement. And the seventh stage is the look-ahead limiting, quantization, noise shaping, and dither. And the eighth stage is visual analysis. This primarily should be able to be translated into any other plugins that do the same things. I go into great detail about the plugins I use because that's what I use. And basically everything in the book is road tested by me, and this is what we get to. So the second chapter is on the listening environment and tuning the ear, the playback listening chain, noise colors, how to flatten your room, these types of things. Chapter 3 is digital audio concepts with sampling and spectral images, and a lot of metaphors are used in here as far as being able to understand how these things work. Like, for instance, a concept of sampling with sample rate and bit depth resolution, I use a metaphor of a flip book, where the flip pages flip at 44.1, and the resolution of the pictures in the flip book have to do with your data resolution. So then chapter 4 is mixing for mastering. So hopefully the ideal input to me, this is like the impedance matching part, and giving a little bit of horror stories of what some people give and don't give, and et cetera. So there's some real world aspects in there. File name conventions, checklist. Chapter 5 is the mastering process, which is just what we go through when we get a file in, for instance. Then chapter 6 is a desktop mastering chain, which is the most detailed thing. And basically, it could have been the whole book, except they asked for 50,000 words. Because what I do has been boiled down a little bit to pretty straightforward aspects. So what I've added, right after that is the sequencing and production master CDs. But what is added here are, hey, welcome. We have lots of celebrities in the audience now. Good grief. What we've added are real-world mastering applications, so things you can do right from the get-go, like capture and master your favorite records and tapes, right, from things that you can do yourself going all the way up to things which are unlikely that you do. One of the things that I do is the Seattle Fireworks audio, which is assembly and editing and mastering that, and I doubt that many people are going to do that, and I sort of hope not because I like the job. I've had it for 6 years. So. And concepts of like your client and opportunity bases are infinite because you can always add one. So, and then mastering as a business, which has a lot of the way that I do my business, and it's worked really well for me. So I'm giving away all my secrets. And then we get into fundamentals of audio, just an introduction and overview of audio, and an introduction to electricity and electronics. So it's a sort of a shallow conceptual guide again. And then a conclusion in audio taxonomy, a glossary of subtle terms that hopefully will grow over time. And my discography, so that all the people that are my clients can see their names in print. You know, they should, at least those will get it. And then a DVD-ROM, which has six songs that Christian and I have done. He did the production and mixing in a very good way, I think, and then I did the mastering. And so it shows what we do to do that. And it has the before, the pre-master in 24-bit and the mastered version after I got done with it, and screenshots of each of the plugins and their settings to say how we got from point A to point B. Okay, did that generate any questions? Great.
So why do we need to master?
Why do you need to master? Okay. I actually made a little video for the book, and this works. Making music is like baking a pie. You've got tracking, mixing, mastering, and distribution. So tracking's like getting the components of the pie together. The fresher the ingredients, the better. Mixing is just that, it's mixing. Just like mixing a pie, and you put the pie into a pan, but you wouldn't want to eat it, an uncooked pie. Okay, so mastering is baking the pie and getting it really yummy smelling and good to hear, essentially. And then distribution is the hot apple pie on the windowsill type of thing. One of the biggest challenges that mixing engineers do, especially in certain points of thought, is send you something that's already partly mastered or half-baked, essentially, and you have to pull back a ways. So it's very important when you bring lead to an alchemist, bring pure lead and not fake gold, you know, if you want to turn it into gold. So that's one of the aspects. Is that reasonable? Yes.
Why 50,000 words? Isn't it your book?
Oh, these things, you know, it's the client is always right. and the next one's 80,000 words.
How'd you get that?
I got that because I got a very good review from Craig Anderton.
So better good reviews, more words you can put in your next book?
No, actually, the thing is, the next book, let me read you the blurb. And what's nice, I've known Craig since like 87, and we're good friends, and Bob wrote a book with him, and we're interacting. I was amazed that he actually took an early version of the book and actually read it, which was nice. And I gave Bob an early version of the book, and he actually read it, and he said, yeah, there's one word wrong in the electronics place. You've got the base of the transistor instead of a gate or something like this. And that said that he read every word. And that was just really, it's really wonderful in that way. So as what this is a boiled down blurb of the review in this month's Electronic Musician magazine on page 53, a half-page review, which was very well-timed in April. And so here's the first blurb. What makes this book stand out from most how-to books is that in addition to useful practical tips and techniques that clearly show Turnage has been around the block multiple times, I'm old, there's a liberal amount of philosophizing and incidental tips that relate to the gestalt of mastering. Think of this more as Zen and the Art of Mastering, and you'll be closer to what this unique book offers, a rare combination of practicality you can take to the bank and insights that broaden your way of looking at the topic. So that was remarkably kind. And what was really nice is, you guys know about Mixer Man. He's an author, and has two books coming. He has one book called Zen and the Art of Mixing, which I'm just finishing up, and it's actually really quite good to read. He's coming out with Zen and the Art of Production, and they needed someone to do Zen and the Art of Mastering. And, you know, with Facebook status messages and the like, it used to be you'd be famous for 15 minutes, and now you're famous for 15 seconds. And the only time you really need to be famous is when someone's making a decision on who to hire. So if you can be famous for the 15 seconds that people are making that decision, then it's a winner. So in those 15 seconds, they were looking for someone to write Zen and the Art of Mastering. This came across the desk. They say, well, of course. And what's nice is this is sort of the book that I've been wanting to write for about 25 years and not knowing how it would come out. And one of the things that really works for me is the universe makes a set list. So whatever is next comes up, you'll know. It's like, this is what's happening. Okay, I'll do it. And that's the way this happened, is the original author of Desktop Mastering that was in process. I was talking Bill Gibson, who's the A&R guy for Hal Leonard, about doing a social networking book, because I do a lot of stuff with social graphs and social networks. How many of you are my Facebook friends? Am I noisy? I'm really, really noisy. Okay, good. So I get a lot of my business from Facebook, and whoever's not my Facebook friend, if you can handle it, feel free. I'd love to connect. I've got cards and everything here. So I talked to him about the way that I approach social networking and asked him to sort of push it into Hal Leonard's world. And, things are slow when you push on them, but when things pull, it's very, very fast. So what happened was the original author of this, which was in process, went AWOL. They didn't know who he was, and they were starting to freak out and say, well, we've got everything in place to make this book happen, but we don't have an author. And so Bill said, well, I know somebody. And I got a phone call. Said, you want to, it was about a year ago right now. So you want to write 50,000 words by July on Desktop Mastering? And that's like the stage manager saying, you're up, go. And you don't just say no, so sure, we'll do that. Even though, again, what I actually do is condensed into a pretty compact form. So that's how I got to write the book.
So how did you get started in mastering?
Now we go into the original... thank you very much. This is very kind. You'll get your tip afterwards. To the original, what I call the preface. And the preface came in, and I got a call, said, this isn't a preface. It's way, way too long. I want one page for a preface. And this is like 14 pages of here. And so no one's going to want to read that. So just boil it down. So I did, and that's what's in the book. But one of the challenges is that this introduction sets up the book. And I actually refer back to it regularly through the book. So that's one of those little first edition issues that we're having. So without further ado, let me get into that. And if you are my Facebook friend, you know that I have a lot of posts on, Gary, hi, when did you get here? On nanotechnology and the singularity and all these different things that are happening to us these days. And so I share that, and that's part of when I first started writing the book, I wanted to write it for the future, for people that were reading over time and over a long period of time. So here's the way it starts. Mastering your music is like mastering your life. It's amazing what happens when you clean up the noise, maximize your good work, and have your music sparkle and shine like you really want it to. This book is written pre-singularity. You'll laugh at some of the primitive tools described here. It's my assumptions regarding the reader. Here are some assumptions I'm making regarding the reader and the environment they find themselves in. First, one of several technologies has been realized. Nanotechnology, quantum computing, spintronics, or other significant technological breakthrough. Secondly, this individual technological advance. Wow. Ghosts. Mm-hmm. Jim,
really
you want to...
It's not a door I particularly want to open.
Ah. Oh, okay. Interesting. Scary. I wonder if that's the singularity knocking at the door. There are no coincidences, right? Okay. Secondly, this individual technological advance enables the rest of the nascent technologies, leading to third... a technological singularity resulting in virtually infinite capacity and technological functionality. These advances, I am assuming, include but are not limited to virtually infinite bandwidth, virtually infinite data storage, and instantaneous communication. It is likely in the years following the first publication of this book that you are reading the book on a device other than a dead tree. So, writing for the future is wrought with peril. I take as a lesson a quote about electricity from Hawkins' Electrical Guide of 1926. Quote, "What is electricity? This is a question that is frequently asked but has not yet been satisfactorily answered. It is a force subject to control under well-known laws. The most modern supposition regarding this matter by Maxwell is that light itself is founded on electricity and that light waves are merely electromagnetic waves. The theory that electricity is related to or identical with the luminiferous ether has been accepted by the most prominent scientists." So when you look 100 years in the past, you see people, you know, making some assumptions that may not set out. So all these taken together suggest the conceptual guide style is a wise direction to take, a shallow overview of a subtle art. This book describes the tools and methods I use every day to maintain a comfortable existence with desktop mastering at its core, including the broader issues of personal networking, marketing, and taking care of business. The tools I describe are in, oh, good, good. Now we've got most of the mastering guys in the city here. The tools I describe are not as important as the techniques, which are transferable to current technological offerings. Some of the ideas presented may initially strike you as unlikely. This is a good thing, the first stage of acceptance. The three stages of acceptance. The first stage of acceptance is, you're crazy, that'll never work, give up now. The second stage of acceptance is, I know that exists, but I have no use for it. And the third stage of acceptance is, of course that's how you do it, what took you so long? So, in my business and dealings, when I hear from others, that'll never work, I smile to myself and understand they have reached the first stage of acceptance. Feel free to skip this next section. I'll be talking a lot about myself and the way I came into working as a mastering engineer from my home with a global audience. So that really was the preface, and then this becomes the introduction. Yeah. Thanks, Jim. Okay, the early years. The story starts with a teenage electronics assembler working on depth sounders, fish finders, for boats. This is what I was doing as a day job while waiting to be a rock star. Got the job from Ray, actually. He was an electronics tech at the place and got me that job as a teenager. After several years of this, into my mid-20s, I realized that rock stardom was becoming increasingly unlikely. While watching circuit board after circuit board go by on the assembly line, I realized I'd prefer to be the one that designed the circuits on the board rather than stuffing components into it, which is the domain of electronics drafting. The kicker for me was that drafters did not have to be able to draw a straight line. They have a T-square for that. Drafting work was generally dry and clean, and you could do a task once and leave it behind. And the drafters always seemed to be able to arrive later than we had to in production. Rockstar hours were just as attractive then. In the early 1980s, I saw Rain Corporation's first demonstration of their product at a local music store, American Music. They presented their products as being inspired by philosophy, which was right up my alley. I spoke with them after the presentation, asking if they had a position available, and they invited me to interview. At that time, they were newly founded and working out of a single warehouse bay. Unfortunately, they had nothing to offer me at the time. This experience with Rain Corporation inspired me to consider beginning my own pro audio company. To do so, I would need some education and chose electronics drafting, a course of which I took from Lake Washington Votech, and completed a year-long course in 8 months. So, actually, as an aside, I'll have lots of asides here. As an aside, I have a company called SynthWorks that does modular synthesizers, and so I've actually gained my goal of having a pro audio company now. It's very exciting. So, Rain Corporation. Soon after I graduated from the drafting course, my drafting instructor phoned me at work asking if I had heard of Rain Corporation. It turned out the five original owners of Rain had been doing their own production level jobs. The time had come that the company had grown enough to allow each owner to focus on management and hire an assistant to handle their day jobs. Welcome. Steve Bracken, the president of Rain Corporation, had been taking care of all of the drafting. Steve asked my former instructor if he had any good candidates for a drafting position to relieve him of those duties. My name came up and I was very excited to hear there was a position available at the company that had inspired me to get this training in the first place. This was 1986, when all the drafting was with pencils on vellum, a kind of thick, semi-transparent paper. And circuit boards were laid out using colored tape on Mylar film. After calling rain every week for some months, and almost making too much of a pest of myself, I won the job and had the pleasure of starting the drafting department at Rain in late 1986. The Rain engineering cabinets were filled with schematics and chassis metal drawings and 36 products worth of printed circuit board designs taped up with transparent colored tape on Mylar film in drawers with a separate piece of film for each layer, pads, top and bottom traces of the circuit boards. Everything was very manual, designs drawn on paper on the drafting boards or laid down with tape and an X-Acto blade on the light table. If you wanted to change something, there was no move command. You erased or ripped up and rerouted. During my three-month review, I was given one critique, that I asked too many questions. This was a surprise, since the questions I asked consisted of, what should I do? From this point on, I gained the attribute of see what needs doing and do it. So computers had just been introduced to engineering, and there was quite a transition from the manual methods to the digital solutions. I had an early version of AutoCAD on a 10 megahertz PC, known at the time as a 286, named for the Intel 80286 CPU. This computer had a 30 megabyte hard drive, the size of one 3-minute 16-bit stereo wave file now. I had my heart set on getting a better PC for home than I had at work, so my home 286 was an 11 megahertz with a 40 meg hard drive. That hard drive sounded like squirrels trying to get out of a box. AutoCAD is a drafting package that at the time was used to basically draw text and lines of different widths. I began the process of transferring all the paper drawings at Rain into AutoCAD. These drawings were primarily electronic schematics and enclosure metal drawings, plotted out with a pen plotter on vellum to take the place of the drafting boards. This provided new freedom via the copy, move, and delete commands. The formerly physical task, drafting, was being virtualized and automated in plotting. You still needed the drafting knowledge, skill, and craft to transfer designs from paper into the computer properly, of course. This took up the first year I was at Rain Corporation. The next year consisted of digitizing all of those Mylar taped up circuit boards using a digitizer tablet and a custom designed layer set I had developed in AutoCAD. By turning on and off layers that replicated the sheets of Mylar, we were able to create several different outputs, which we plotted up at four times actual size. These were photographed and reduced to create films for printed circuit board fabrication. We took this physical task, laying tape on Mylar film, and virtualized it and automated it. If we needed to move a channel of a headphone amp, now we could just select the items on the computer screen and move them. This was a great time saver and was more accurate as well. We all dreaded getting prototype circuit boards back from production to find that we had accidentally dropped a bit of layout tape across the film or dislodged a component pad. Those days were behind us, but they happened back in the day a lot. The next year at Rain, we addressed the product cosmetics, front and rear panel designs, lines and text, which were previously designed by cutting printed typographical letters out of sheets and pasting them up. A new process was created to generate the product artwork using the lines in AutoCAD instead. This involved drawing each line thickness in a different drawing and having each drawing photoplotted on a piece of film that the silkscreen department made their screens from. Again, we took a physical task, virtualized and automated it, while still retaining the design and ergonomic artistry to create a good-looking product. The next year, I learned the infant technology of desktop publishing and was in charge of creating manuals and data sheets, and all desktop publishing, including patent illustrations and Rain notes. Rain's great line of white papers, and here I have a point to rain.com, Rain notes, which actually Bob and I had to have. Bob worked at Rain from 88 to 95 or 6, and we had to do a skunk works to get the first website up because they were saying, don't waste your time on that stuff. And they were one of the first websites to have to go up in the pro audio world, and we had to fight twice as hard to get things up in PDF as far as schematics and all that kind of stuff, and later that turned out to work pretty well. Anyway, so I am fully grateful to this day to have been working in such a rich information environment at Rain, where just going to work every day increased my knowledge base about music, audio, and computing, all topics I loved. During the next several years at RAIN, I put the See What Needs Doing and Do It lesson to work vigorously. First, we networked the company, now using a now very primitive serial networking product, Lantastic, a 2 megabit serial network, in which a network cable had to be run from computer to computer and terminated at each end. If there was a break in the line or someone kicked out the plug, the entire network went down. This product was optimally designed for 5 or so computers. We had it barely working with 42 computers. A couple of years later, Ethernet became more affordable, so we rewired the building with Cat5 cable, taking advantage of a new marketing and engineering wing being added to the building. This led to lots of climbing through the ceilings. The next stage, while I was climbing around the rafters anyway, was to become a certified Intertel telephone technician and install a new phone system into RAIN. Those were years of collecting skill sets. By 1998, all the engineering and computer tasks were settled, and I was comfortable with the title of systems manager, being available to answer questions about the different processes we had put into place and being the IT guy for the company. The next stop and skill set required to advance was to get into the financial databases and business issues. This was a challenge as it was not where my passions led. So, now I haven't actually read this since I wrote it, so this is sort of fun world. PAVO and Digital Harmony is the next main section. PAVO was a company founded by Greg Bartlett to be a kit fulfillment house for a book he and Bob Moses wrote with Craig Anderton in 1994, Digital Projects for Musicians. This was a do-it-yourself book with 20 various MIDI utility projects called MIDI tools. Greg fulfilled the kits and readers would design products with them. Several readers were serious enough that they went into business marketing their projects and needed to have the products professionally designed and manufactured, and that was the business PAVO found itself in. Bob Moses had worked at RAIN Corporation as the digital audio engineer. He had designed a 64 times oversampling CD decoder as his thesis product in 1985 and successfully put it on the market under the Wadia Digital name. Bob had always been ahead of the curve, and that actually went really big in Japan. In 1996, Microsoft called RAIN to ask about a new high-speed interface called FireWire, and if RAIN could put audio across it. Dennis Bond, the chief engineer who was fully analog design genius, wasn't ready for a digital project quite yet and forwarded the call to Bob. Bob took a prototype DSP board into the chicken coop lab behind his house and managed to be the first to successfully stream audio over FireWire. Bill Gates demonstrated his product at a Microsoft hardware trade show that year, and Bob's FireWire chops became legendary. Bob decided to leave RAIN and pool his work with Greg Bartlett, starting up a new company in addition to PAVO, Digital Harmony, a company that specialized in FireWire hardware and firmware solutions. Bob gave me a call near the end of 1998, inviting me to join his engineering team and design their engineering operations. PAVO Digital Harmony designed and produced products and provided engineering services. The company was located across the street from Pioneer Square in one of the oldest buildings in Seattle. That's where I met Christian as well. And when the big earthquake happened, it's a very, very old building. Lots of mortar came out from between the bricks, and he was in the oldest part of the building, and I was in an engineering meeting where we all dove under a table about this size, about 14 of us. Anyway, so moving from RAIN to PAVO Digital Harmony was a real shock to my system. I left a comfortable job where after 11 years I could answer almost any question and fell into a rather chaotic system at the very edges of complexity, with the task of organizing and delivering several products that were due within a few weeks of my arrival. It took most of a year to get things settled there, but we were reasonably successful in connecting on the FireWire side with many in the pro audio world. I had returned to printed circuit board design, as well as the design of part numbering systems and engineering operations. The work at Digital Harmony lasted until 2001, when the tech bubble burst. It was a time to decide what to do with my life. Get a new job and sacrifice 40 to 60 hours a week to a company, or go into golden poverty and fulfill my personal passion, mastering. I made a decision to strike out on my own, gathering up and offering all the skills I had acquired along the way. So, the audio class. The wife of one of the engineers at Digital Harmony was Dean of Humanities at Shoreline Community College, and she had a need of an audio recording instructor to fill in for a year of classes while the teacher, who had taught audio recording there for 25 years, including a class I had taken 20 years before, was on sabbatical. I knew recording, I could teach the class as one of my new pursuits. Hallucinating things behind me. This turned out to be a meaningful decision, since that instructor had taught the class verbally up to that point for all those years. I had to generate three consecutive quarters of instruction based on a syllabus consisting of two or three sentences per week. Teaching these classes put concrete in the foundations of my audio knowledge, taking about 10 hours of research for each hour of class time. Also, teaching the class introduced me to the students, many of whom became good friends and mastering clients in the years to follow. In addition to sharing my desktop mastering processes, I'll include some fundamental audio and electronics information gleaned from teaching the class in this book as well. So, now we get to what we're here for. What is mastering? The concept of mastering was always very mysterious, and in the mid-1990s at RAIN, I started looking into finding out for real what it involved. We had a really great engineering library at RAIN. You could look up everything and anything to do with audio. I read all the books that mentioned mastering, and they told about every other part of the audio chain in detail. But when it came to describing mastering, they typically would say, at this point, send it to a mastering engineer and get it back. And there would be nothing at all about the mastering process itself. I asked a well-educated friend that I trusted about what mastering is. And he replied, oh, I know what mastering is. There's this new thing called the Waves L1 Ultra Maximizer. And you just put your audio through there and it comes out the other side mastered. So I picked up a copy of the software. Chucky Boy Records. In 1983, I played in a synth-pop band in Seattle called The Ultraviolet Catastrophe, aka UVC, with Ray. And we would often play with another band called Color Twigs, which was Gordon Raphael's band. Gordon later went on to produce The Strokes' first album. Color Twigs had a bunch of music that I had put onto VHS Hi-Fi from the original quarter-inch two-track tape in the 1980s. VHS Hi-Fi was one of the highest fidelity recording means available to us wannabe rock stars in the mid-80s. UVC and Color Twigs never released any albums publicly. In 1996, one of the first Carver CD recorders came out, and Steve McAtee had one at RAIN. I was so excited to bring the recorder home and compile several of my early works and bands onto CD. This was quite the novelty at the time. I had some Color Twigs music on VHS Hi-Fi, so I recorded from the VHS Hi-Fi onto the CD recorder and thought it was really cool. Gordon came over soon after that. We hadn't seen him for a few years. And I had the opportunity to play the Color Twigs CD track and tell him, hey, your music is on CD, which was very exciting at the time. Gordon later went out to lunch with Michael Stein, owner of Chucky Boy Records, a small Seattle label that specialized in releasing CDs by early 80s Seattle bands. Michael had once played drums in Color Twigs and was wondering about the state of the masters for the Color Twigs work. Gordon, having recently heard his music on CD, said, well, Steve has a CD of it already. Michael called me at RAIN and made an appointment to come over and get the masters from the VHS Hi-Fi tape. Michael and I had first met at a Northwest Electronic Musicians meeting in 1992, Michael being guest speaker, and being late to the meeting was the germ of Northwest Cyber Artists, an art and technology group I helped start up in 1993 with Bob. That's a whole story by itself. So Michael came over to get a digital audio tape, a DAT tape of the Color Twigs audio. My best version of the music was on VHS Hi-Fi, so we started a transfer to the DAT. And listening to it, realized the sound quality was horrible. I couldn't let that get out like that. I told Michael, I really can't give you this. I have a copy of SoundForge upstairs, and I have this Ultra Maximizer, so I can master it for you. So the Color Twigs album turned out to be the first album I mastered, but not until I learned what the Ultra Maximizer really does, is make everything more. So if the track is sibilant, it becomes more sibilant. If the track is boomy, the Ultra Maximizer makes it more boomy. Any blemishes in the music, they become maximized and amplified. These discoveries ultimately set the foundation of my process, which is to make the files absolutely neutral and then go through the Ultra Maximizer, which then makes the neutral sound more, resulting in a beautiful and natural sounding file. That is the story of how I came into mastering and began the development of the desktop mastering chain. Applying these discoveries to my first mastering attempt on the Color Twigs material resulted in a significantly better version than was originally on VHS Hi-Fi, but as the CD was being prepared for release, Gordon remembered a few more original tracks that should be included. So this led for a hunt for the mixed down reel-to-reel tapes, which fortunately we found after calling one of our old friends from back in the day. We transferred the reels onto DAT, and I had another go at the mastering. And Sticks and Stoned by Colored Twigs became my first mastered release. At that time, one of the things I was playing with was the Sonic Foundry noise reduction plugin, because the original tape was more noise to signal than signal to noise. At the it was so present that any volume increase brought the noise up significantly. At the end of the project, I learned enough to get a pretty good result with a disc. There was a track where Gordon rattled a little bracelet in front of the microphone before one of his songs, and he had never heard that sound come out of the song before, so he was happy with the results. So that is what no one else has ever seen, so I don't know if it was appropriate. Questions or comments?
About what year was that?
The 97, 98. Yeah, and one of the things that I do have in here is a discography, just to show, basically, because I started in my bedroom, or in a second room, and Rick Fisher came in, and Steve Fisk introduced me to Rick at my very first Recording Academy event that I went to, which was probably 2001 or 2002. And Rick says, so Rick's a real mastering engineer, so is Bruce. These guys are real guys. And he says, so how long have you been doing this? And so I said, well, 3 years? Okay, and he expected me to just go into the sunset. But fortunately, most of the work that doesn't go to me goes to him, or that doesn't go to him goes to me. I don't know. It doesn't matter. So that was 1997, 12/11/1997. And then I started doing a lot of Chucky Boy releases, which the Heats and the Cowboys, which were early Seattle bands, I mastered them, and we have both of those as door prizes here. We had the U-Men did that, Free World, a lot of just local stuff that came up. So that's the introduction. There. Any other leading questions? Yes.
Do you see a future for CDs?
A future for CDs? Well, CDs are only a carrier. It's just a way, just, you know, like records have their future back. I know that I still have my laser discs. Lots of them. I don't think there's a lot of future for laser discs, but there are things that haven't been released yet on them or in other mediums. So, yeah, I see a future for CDs actually a lot. There are a lot of people have these things called iPods these days. That seems to be catching on. So what would be next? I guess I can show you, let's see, any other questions? We can get in, let's go into the conceptual overview, actually, of desktop mastering. I think that would be a good way to start, and that would get us up to...
What distinguishes desktop mastering from real guys as you...
Real guys as... Well, it's. I think what we... this used to be called...
I think you're a real guy. Too.
Tips and... Well, thank you. This used to be called... the subtitle was Tips and Techniques for Mastering Inside the Box. And they got rid of that. So let's talk about in the box. Well, I think, actually, it says it in here. It's in the box and out of the box. The thing that was, let's go in here one moment. Yes. It's in here, so I'm going to read this bit. And something I did realize lately, is what you can do by being all in the boxes compared to out of the box for the audio interfaces that you need. There's the biggest difference, I think, between in the box and out of the box. Is that in out of the box, your audio interface both out into other, which means going out into external processors as compared to having everything inside the computer, is what in the box and out of the box is talking about. If you go out of the box into external processors, the actual music, the actual bits that you're working with have to be reproduced in the outside world So your audio interface is actually dealing with what's going to end up on the release. And so the audio interface has to be as good as it can be, completely, and both going out and coming back in. When you're mastering in the box, you get sort of a pass in that your audio interface only has to be good enough for you to be able to make decisions accurately and listen to. So that sort of cuts down the million-dollar studio in a way. So that's one of the primary things. So, conceptual overview of desktop mastering. There are three types of mastering: cosmetic, aesthetic, and restorative, just as in dentistry. One of the nice things about this kind of thing is I was having a tooth replaced. And my dentist had an intern at the time that he was waxing academic towards. And he talked about cosmetic, aesthetic, and restorative dentistry in this way. Cosmetic dentistry is used to make shiny, brilliant teeth that stand out in a crowd and look great in smiles walking up the red carpet. Aesthetic dentistry is used to match the nearby teeth to make the set appear to be a whole, the work looking natural as if it were meant to be that way. Restorative dentistry brings back into order the functionally incorrect, removing unpleasant and dysfunctional aspects while adding what is necessary to restore the patient to full health. In mastering, you have the opportunity to provide similar services to your clients. Electronica, hip-hop, rock, and pop can sparkle and shine and rise above the crowd with cosmetic mastering. Jazz, classical, and location recording benefit from aesthetic presentation in a clear and unadorned way, accurately portraying the performances without distraction. Forensic and archival mastering restores damaged and noisy sources to intelligible carriers of information. Sometimes the archival restoration is the first step, to be followed by a cosmetic or aesthetic change for final presentation. So capturing from records and cassettes and these and VHS hi-fi and things that are in the history, you get it back to being new, you know, ready to begin, and then you begin. So it's the other thing that was fortunate is in 1999, I was fortunate to have, whenever this was, Craig Anderton come over, and I showed him what I was doing with the noise reduction plugin. And so he asked me to write 10 tips and tricks for EQ Magazine in 1999 on the noise reduction, Sonic Foundry noise reduction plugin at the time. And so that was very kind. And he was on a panel with Steve Fisk, and that's how I met Steve Fisk. And he was very, very kind to introduce us.
You've done several projects, many projects, restorative for archival, archives.
Yeah, and what has been interesting is with some record labels, to remain nameless, they give me records, and I actually capture the record and make the CD from the record ultimately. And then on the CD release party, there's one in particular that I will not name, one of the original band members came up and said, "So where did you get your source material?" I said, "Well, I have the records." "I have the original tapes. Why didn't you come and ask me?" Which actually has been something that's happened occasionally through different licensing things. People that originally have things don't like it when you don't ask. But that's why the label's there. Anyway, so, carrying on. Shoulders of giants, the path to the present. Historically, mastering has been a process of transformation, typically from one medium of information storage to another. Throughout most of mastering's history, the goal behind it was to physically lathe vibration forms into the groove of a disc. This process required significant skill and craft, and the pool of accomplished mastering engineers was limited. A series of tools were at the mastering engineer's disposal, specifically purpose-built to inscribe the most delicate of details onto the production master disc, which would then be the template for thousands of commercially released duplications of it. Mastering then evolved with the introduction of the cassette tape, which had its own limitations to be finessed. Finally, with the introduction of the compact disc, the age of digital mastering was upon us. The mastering engineers had a substantial learning curve to overcome, the finesse needed to eke out the finest details from vinyl, and the tricks required to do so did not translate well at first to the CD. One of the tricks used to keep phonograph styli in the groove was a frequency equalization process called the RIAA curve, which reduces low frequencies that would toss the stylus around and increases high frequencies to capture the sound in finer detail. Phonograph preamplifiers have a complementary, equal and opposite, filter curve built in to boost the low frequencies and reduce high frequency content, with the benefit of reduced hiss, but the liability of higher rumble. Some of the earliest transfers to CDs retain the aspects of this earlier technology, resulting in a lack of low end and a brittle high end. Over a period of time, experience had its way, and the mastering industry found its niche, and the age of the CD eclipsed all the media that had come before. And one thing in the book are lots of QR codes. So this QR code leads to probably the Wikipedia page on RIAA equalization. So the nice thing too is that this points to mydesktopmastering.com domain and then can be pointed out to something else. So if it breaks over time or if somebody doesn't want me to point there, I can shift wherever any one of these goes, which also means the publisher needs to be very nice to me over time. I wouldn't do that. So the external mastering chain. The one consistent thread among mastering engineers up until the late 1980s and beyond was that they all used functional components chained together to do their job. The use, order, and settings of these components were the distinguishing factors among mastering engineers. The mastering process has been transformed by the technological and computational evolution. This shift is from out of the box, which is something of a misnomer since there are many boxes used in external mastering chains, toward in the box or desktop mastering, where the full processing functionality of the mastering chain is controlled and applied inside a desktop computer. The majority of mastering engineers at the time of this writing employ a hybrid system, typically running a number of processes with outboard gear while bringing the pre-mastered audio into their digital environment. The desktop mastering chain has developed and evolved fully in the box for more than a decade and is what I have to share with you. There is at least one overlapping requirement regardless of where the processing lies. An appropriate and accurate reproduction chain is necessary to inform the choices at the heart of the mastering process. Being able to hear what you're doing and knowing what to do are at the core of mastering. So, good? Questions? Carrying on? So, if I read you the entire book, you don't really have to buy it, so we're going to get into actually hearing things probably after the break. So, the desktop mastering chain. The real focus of this book is the concept of the bundle of functionality, which in desktop mastering is a specific and functional chain of plug-in processors within a digital audio workstation environment. The functionality of the whole is a synergetic superset of each individual processor. All mastering, and audio for that matter, boils down to only two aspects, frequency and level. Does anyone disagree with that? Is there anything other than frequency and level that ultimately has to do with audio? Okay, that's stereo.
Perception.
Okay, good. I was hoping not to get any answers because it made a sort of statement. But yeah, so that's frequency and level. The primary function of any mastering chain is to balance frequencies and provide the desired level in each channel, whether it is a slamming, highly compressed signal or a delicate, quiet passage. The desktop mastering chain can be realized with any number of tools from different providers. You don't have to use my specific chain. It's one of the reasons why I used old technology in here too. Finding what works for you in your situation is the fun part, and that is one of the reasons I'll go into detail about my specific setup. It is what works for me. Taking a journey of discovery often leads to finding new ways of solving old problems and distinguishing yourself as a provider of a unique service at the same time. So here are my desktop mastering functional component stages. Setting up the desktop mastering chain as in sculptural technique begins with crude moves to bring the audio file into a generally balanced frequency spectrum with levels optimized for the next stages in the chain. The first stage is low-end frequency control. The minimal functionality needed for this first stage is a high-pass filter set at 20 Hz, a general level control, and some low-frequency equalization. The prime function of this first stage is to minimize potentially uncontrolled energy in the low end. Low frequency energy is often out of balance and literally takes up the most room of any waveform. Taming it here allows the rest of the chain to have the most headroom possible for its processes. Second stage, noise reduction. The next stage is low-level noise reduction used to expand the dynamic range of the material, the difference between the loudest and softest sounds in the file. Ideally, the noise reduction stage has a frequency setting component that allows shaping of the reduction threshold curve, the tuning of which is required for excellent overall results. This stage is like washing the windows. You may not realize how bad they were until they're clean. So that is something in my early days when I started to put on the noise reduction for those early tapes in order to get the hiss out of there. I was finding that when it was tuned appropriately, that for some reason the bass was sounding clearer and the guitars were sounding clearer and all the different pieces. And so I was figuring, if you have a dirty window and you look out the window and the sky is dirty and the trees are dirty and the car is dirty, clean the window and the sky is clean and the trees are clean and the car is clean. So all the different instruments actually are enhanced. It was really a surprising thing and wonderful. And done while it's young, so as you get them when they're young. So you do these things not after you've taken gain. So the third stage is stereo enhancement, also done small. Now that the low frequencies are controlled and the noise floor has been dropped, it is time to provide subtle stereo enhancement. The processor in this stage provides overall stereo phase and channel balancing control, as well as a method to widen the sound stage. These actions are all taken before turning the level up, or taking gain, which happens a couple of stages down the road. Gain staging is a critical concept. A properly gain staged chain of processor levels are set so that any clipping that occurs on the first processor simultaneously clips the rest of the chain. I learned that in an AES meeting. This ensures the maximum headroom and dynamic range for the entire chain. In contrast, if the output of one stage is set at a very quiet level, and the next stage has to have its input turned way up to compensate, what you're actually turning up is the noise present in both stages. The better way to set gain is to have output set as loudly as possible without clipping the next stage. That way, the input can be set very low and still provide sufficient and necessary volume without turning up unnecessary noise. Fourth stage, optional, reverb. Very rarely, a track comes in that is dry as a bone, and it practically scrapes as it travels through the plug-in chain. In these cases, and at this stage of the chain, I'll provide some very subtle and light reverb, just enough to restore the illusion that there are people playing together in a room. I've had to use reverb in this way perhaps 5 times out of more than 200 projects. And what I'm finding too is there are specific clients that need it every time. And I'll use like a Waves Reverb, R-Verb type thing. And the mix is out of 100, like 4 or 3. And because we turn it up later, everything gets enhanced later. So the fifth stage is occasional, and actually it's occasionally more these days, is de-essing. The de-esser provides a complementary function to the first low frequency control stage, only for high frequencies. The explicit purpose of this stage is to set up the high end for the next stage, controlling S and sh sounds, and leveling out the top octaves for upper mid-range expansion. And one of the things that I've discovered is that de-essers typically have two states. They have the notch filter that takes care of a given frequency range, and then they have just all the high frequencies above a certain level to take down. And I'm finding that a lot of times, if you look at a sonogram of a sibilant area, you'll see this tower of sibilants that goes all the way up. And since mastering is in the frequency domain, mixing is in time domain. Mixing takes verse, works on it, chorus, works on it, bridge, all of these different times, gets them right. Mastering looks at all those at once and say, I never want that frequency to be any louder than this. So you're controlling the whole thing. I'm finding that the de-esser right before my multiband compressor, the C4, really handles the high end nicely because I can turn those things that have been sort of homogenized back up in the C4 as far as the high end goes. So just like the low end can be controlled for people who are mixing like without a subwoofer and want it to be as loud as they expect it to be, and in order to get their speakers to make the sounds they're trying to hear, they completely overdo the low end. So you control that. the high end is in a similar way, because you never, my clients, because I'm reasonably inexpensive and I like it this way, are people doing stuff in their bedrooms or project studios all over the place. And I have, I'm part of a record label called Burning Sky Records. And we do tribute albums, and we did a tribute to Jellyfish, which was a band from the early 90s. They had two albums out, Belly Button and Spilt Milk, and we did every song in order, plus all their unreleased and live tracks in this ultimate tribute to Jellyfish. And my partner at the time, who started the project, and I sort of found him, and set, and the MySpace page he had looked and sounded horrible. Oh, wait, this is being recorded. Hi, Alan. But I got in touch with him and said, you know, I'd love to help you. And what was nice, that started a great partnership where he worked with all the artists and sort of filtered everybody in. So that first project was 35 bands from all around the world. And so bands from England and Spain and Argentina and Japan, and all these people were sending stuff. And I was able to master one track each of theirs, and so they heard what I could do, and they often came back and had me do their whole albums, which was great. We went on to do a 3-disc tribute to the Posies with 45 tracks, a 3-disc tribute to Roxy Music that had early, later, and Roxy Progeny, a 4-disc, the original 4 Squeeze albums, tribute, and then a tribute to a New Zealand punk band called Toy Love from the late 80s. All in all, we did about 165 different bands by doing that. And these bands were everywhere from really scary. Probably the funniest submission I got was very, very small. I asked for a WAV file, and this person, who also will remain nameless, sent me the icon for Cubase off their desktop. This is it, right? So that was interesting. Anyway, so.
So a lot of this was on tape, right? The original stuff was on tape, and you got it in what?
No, because this was from like 2007.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this was all WAV files.
Oh, okay.
But I also got a lot of things that came in completely slammed and all different.
What about Roxy, though?
Pardon?
Roxy was older, right?
No, the first one was Jellyfish in, I think, 2006.
Oh, okay.
And the Roxy, I've got some of these here for door prizes. So, that was de-essing. Sixth stage, the multiband compression, expansion, and equalization. This stage may be a bit challenging to emulate, as I use a WAVE C4 multiband parametric processor, which provides 4 band of compression expansion plus dynamic equalization. Previously, before the C4, I used a 10-band EQ and a 4-band multiband dynamics processor to take care of the issues that this single processor solves. This is the stage where you need to balance the frequency range with a high level of detail. The coarse aspects of the file have been smoothed out previously in the chain, and now it's time to provide kick and punch to the track. The low end of the multiband compressor has a very fast attack and release, allowing the kick drum and bass to be dynamic and moving. The most critical section of the entire chain is the upper mid-range of this stage, which is the residence of articulation. This section is where the signal, having been conditioned by the de-esser, is expanded and requires much finer control. Tenths of a decibel make significant changes here. Like a series of levers, the stages are amplified in very noticeable steps at this stage. The earlier stages of bypass are extremely subtle, providing general direction to the sound as compared with the processing here. The main secret of all the stages up to and including this point is to make the file absolutely neutral so that nothing sticks out and all is smooth and clear. The reason this is important is because the look-ahead limiter is coming up next. Seventh stage, look-ahead limiting, quantization, noise shaping, and dither. This is the culmination of the chain. Everything that has been set up to this point has been specifically tuned to be presented to the final limiter. This is a stage that is commonly misused and is misused if it is applied significantly prior to this very last stage. When pre-masters are subjected to brick wall limiters and hard compression, the job of the mastering engineer becomes one of restoration. Compression in all its forms, while useful as a tool, can be devastating as a weapon. This stage makes everything more. If there is sibilance or boominess, they are aggravated here. The other critical functions provided by this stage are quantization, dither, and noise shaping. Quantization is the intelligent reduction in bit depth from typically 24 bits to 16 bits. The wrong way to quantize is called truncation, which is just chopping off the last 8 bits of the digital word. Using intelligent quantization, together with a distortion-reducing technique called dither, provides a file ready to be released on CD. Noise shaping gathers unavoidable digital noise, a result of digital signal processing, and mathematically moves the noise to the highest audible frequencies, generally around 18 to 19 kilohertz. This also is a function which must be done last. The next digital process on the file collapses the noise back out to the whole frequency range while leaving the previous noise shaping heap up at the top of the range. This presents us with an object lesson. Tools, if used incorrectly, can leave a bad taste and give a lasting and potentially wrong opinion regarding the utility of the tool. For instance, if you pour a big mound of salt in your hand and throw it into your mouth, you're likely to have a lasting distaste for salt. However, in cooking, we smell the delicate differences within the food and determine too much of this, not enough of that, and balance it out, in which case salt is a necessity. As mastering engineers, our job is to listen and perceive the flavors of the sound and modify the recipe to match the ingredients. In the end, the track has the potential to be delicious. Eighth stage, visual analysis. Never operate without an X-ray. This is the visual representation of your work, and you should have a phase display and frequency display. In addition to a software analyzer, I recommend you have and constantly use a hardware real-time analyzer to observe the balance and motion of the sound. So that is the conceptual overview of the thing.
Is that a good breaking point there?
It is a good, well, let's do any questions. Would be good, and also things of what we're going to do afterwards. Yeah.
Are you listening to each stage, or are you listening to the television?
That's a good question. At the beginning of when I did this, in 1997, the computing horsepower was not enough to be able to hear the whole chain. And so it was a really good learning experience. So what I would do back then is listen for something that bothered me, run a pass of whatever fixed it, and then listen again to whatever would bother me, run a pass, and eventually it would be neutral again and be able to go to the ultra maximizer. And at that point, the passes were very long, like, you know, 4 or 5. They weren't real time. They were very long, computationally intensive things. But one of the benefits that it gave was, like, for instance, at the noise reduction stage, because it was separated out, to go to the end of the question, now I listen to it all together and tune it all as one thing. But with the noise reduction stage, I found a great trick. The way noise reduction works in this case is there's 1,000 noise gates across the frequency range. And each of those are set down around, you know, minus 90 dB or more. And if the audio level at that range goes below that threshold, it's ducked 20 dB. And then when the audio range comes up, level comes up, it'll pop right back up. So there's a bit of a time in that. And what I found out that worked really well is noise is the same forwards or backwards. So what I would do is reverse the file to run the noise reduction, because that made the attacks, actually they were the releases, the attacks are now slow, and the gates can open up very comfortably, and the releases are now, or the attacks, are really fast, so they pull off like this. And then you turn it around again, and all of a sudden the noise gates open up and your audio's there and comes down. So that was really useful that I can't do anymore. The other thing back in the day was that SoundForge at that time, if you cut anything off the beginning of the file, it would have to rewrite the entire file, and it would be like 4, 5, 6 minutes. I've tried to forget how long this would take. But if you cut it off the end of the file, it wouldn't rewrite the file. So what I would do is, while it was reversed for my noise reduction thing, I would cut what was the beginning of the file off the end and then reverse it back, since I had to do that anyway. So that was and then do tops that way, tops and tails.
So maybe I missed, are you running this through processing and then listening to it
I'm listening to what is being...
Real time.
Now to real time, now to today. Yeah, absolutely. I listen to it as it's happening and
it's
tune it.
The process faster than you can.
Pardon me?
Faster than real time.
Yeah, it's much more convenient now, and it's educational still to hear and watch it go by. So, yes.
So you've gotten good enough, so you can listen, so you find what bothers you and make it go backwards and still bothers you, fix it backwards and you can still sound good?
No, I can't do it backwards anymore because the noise reduction stage is in between my whole chain. And so
yeah,
there's no place.
Yeah.
But one thing that did happen from that is I got a chance to listen to a lot of music backwards. It was really interesting because there's this one gospel choir that had this female vocalist with an extremely, I think I did for you, had an extremely round voice, and turn it around, and the attacks were as the same as her releases, and it sounded like aliens, real angelic aliens. And so we pulled that out and used it in a song called President UFO. It was really, wow, it's up on SoundCloud. If you go to SoundCloud, my area is Ars Divina. And it's up there. It has some samples.
Steve, I have a question. I don't know, it's a good question, but I'm curious if you could elaborate more on the noise reduction. Like, is it just each track is different, or is there something you find regularly or areas where you're reducing noise?
I already wrote this, so.
Okay, yeah.
Now, as far as time, are we thirsty, or would anyone like a break now, or in a couple minutes? Because I'm happy
later,
to.
I'm just curious from my own perspective.
It's pretty, votes, care. If you don't say, it means you don't care, so I'll carry on.
Right.
Okay, sounds good, sweet. So, in the chain, you were asking about the noise reduction.
Just if you could elaborate a little more.
Sure.
That part interests me because if you're reducing noise, or at least when I've messed with those types of plugins in the past, you're also affecting the frequency.
You totally are.
The
well,
same ranges. And where do you draw the line of noise reduction and affecting the overall sound? Because sometimes I feel like reducing the noise affects the sound too much.
It totally does if you do it wrong. So, because you get a complement of whatever you're hearing.
Well, sure, at least I can hear it, and I usually wouldn't use it if I felt like it was taking away from the track, or at least I wouldn't use it too extensively.
Okay, so here we have tuning the noise print. So here, let's go one moment.
Making it better versus...
Okay, so one of the things that's critical is that when you keep residue, which is what's taken out when you run the noise print, you have a button that says keep residue. It's,
right.
It's the stuff that's taken out. And, well, I've got pictures of it here. If you can raise or lower your thresholds all at once. And if you raise it high, then the residue sounds like the full file.
Right.
And as you come down, it gets... It gets really sort of garbly. So if you go down so you don't hear any tonal aspects, and no mechanical machine stuff, but just have sort of a pink, white noise,
mm-hmm.
then that's all we're really doing with it. We're not necessarily reducing noise. We're actually increasing the dynamic range so that you can turn it up 20 dB and still have the noise floor at the same place.
Okay.
And that's...
So using it very subtly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So... After you've modified the noise print to be relatively flat, so one thing you with noise reduction, you take a noise print of what you want to have the curve look like, and then it sets the gates to go the audio frequency ranges of that curve that you give it. And what I find to be absolutely critical is being able to change that curve after the fact, after you've taken the noise print, because most of the time it's going to be much higher in the bass than you want it to be. So you want to, it'll look, you know, well, to you, it'll look flattened out. Not sure, you know, it's been a while. You know how, okay. So if you get that down, and then you select all the threshold points, check the keep residual output box. I got to where I'm at here. Play the file and listen to the scritchy sounds coming out. Next, slowly lift all the selected thresholds up until the output sounds like the full range audio. Then slowly pull the line of threshold boxes down until you are just hearing noise without too much music content. As you listen to the residual noise, you'll hear a robotic, machine-like grinding sound at some point between the full audio and the quiet noise settings. It is important to understand that the complement of this sound is heard in the music, which is one way to detect and hear a poorly calibrated noise reduction stage. In general, the noise reduction is set correctly when there is minimal tonal content in the residue. This noise gate threshold level is a variable setting depending on the incoming audio. Sometimes you want to carve out a bunch of low-level distortion that's getting in the way of clarity further down the chain. I've worked with noisy punk bands that benefited quite a lot from harsh hash reduction. In the greatest number of cases, the threshold setting will generally be around 90 dB or lower, almost imperceptible. These days, I've taken to having a standard noise print start setting. If more tuning is necessary for the particular track, I'll seek out an appropriate noise print. Otherwise, I'll set the threshold level as described above, and that typically takes care of this stage of the chain. The practical function of the noise reduction plugin is to provide a dynamic range enhancement. Later on in the chain, when we take gain, the low-level noise that was at minus 90 dB doesn't become a much more audible minus 70 dB if we go up 20 dB. Since we're dropping the noise floor by 20 dB, we have that much more headroom. In this case, the gain can be increased by 20 dB later on down the chain, and the noise floor will be perceived as having the same level as the pre-mastered track, but be much louder at the time.
Steve, what are you typically using to do that these days?
The Sony noise reduction plugin, the same thing. The Waves X Noise also, I think, has control. The main thing that I'd recommend is something that you are able to move. The RX suite as well, the Isotope RX suite, wonderful as well. If you can change the tonal quality of what the residue is going to be, and after the fact, after taking the noise print, that's the key of being able to do this, so it doesn't turn into a problem. Okay.
And we'll probably break there.
Yeah, that sounds good. And okay. So we've got cookies. We've got water.
Yeah, for those of you that came in late, we have sign-up sheets here. We have drawing, lots of CDs, and two of Steve's books here that we're giving away. So please sign up the sheet.
Right. Okay.